This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab. Adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of WNYC Studios and the New Yorker.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. McDonald's, Burger King, KFC, and so many other fast food franchises are truly emblematic American enterprises, as much as Ford or U.S. Steel. And on any given day, it's estimated that a third of Americans eat some kind of fast food. It's part of our after-school rituals, our workday lunches, our road trips. We know all that, and we've all read about the effect on the national health, too. But what's less known is that fast food is also deeply and unexpectedly intertwined with the struggle for civil rights in this country. Marcia Chatelain, a historian at Georgetown, recently won the Pulitzer Prize for History for her book called Franchise, The Golden Arches in Black America. And she looks at how McDonald's managed to leverage the social upheaval of the 60s into a permanent foothold in Black communities across the country. And in the decades since, Black franchise owners have navigated the economic promise and the economic pitfalls of that corporate relationship. I spoke with Professor Chatelain earlier this week. Where did you grow up and what was your relationship with McDonald's when you were growing up?
So I grew up in Chicago in the 1980s, and I grew up in a time where it wasn't a big deal if your kids ate McDonald's all the time. We could eat McDonald's after church. I went to McDonald's with my friends. And I think as a kid who grew up without the internet, this is where our social exchanges happened. It was, you know, sharing a giant tray of French fries at McDonald's.
Well, fast forward to your career as a historian. How do you pick this subject of all subjects arrayed in front of you to write about McDonald's and its effect on and its interrelationship with Black community in the United States?
Well, I think part of it is growing up Black in a big city and having all of these interactions with McDonald's that go beyond having, you know, a hamburger and a milkshake. And I remember going away to college. I went to the University of Missouri in Columbia and meeting other Black students from Kansas City or St. Louis, or, you know, Detroit, and saying, like, how many of you have scholarships that were sponsored by Black McDonald's operators? And a lot of us did. And that was always such a point of curiosity to me, the way that everyone knew what McDonald's was, but you wouldn't know who the franchise owner was, because mm-hmm. that person didn't have this unofficial kind of title in the community. But when you talked to other Black people my age, McDonald's had this other life that was tied to historically Black colleges, that was tied to sports, that was tied to community activities. And for me, you know, this was just a fact of my life. And it wasn't until, you know, I was training to be a historian in graduate school that I thought, this is kind of a strange way of understanding corporate relations in people's everyday life. And that's partly why I wrote this book, to see how we got here and why that is a fundamental problem if we're serious about addressing racial and economic justice.
Now, your research really starts in the 60s, and you argue that the assassination of Dr. King in 68 was a turning point in corporate America's relationship with Black communities. And so how does McDonald's capitalize on that moment, and in what spirit?
Well, after King's assassination, there are all of these questions about what directions the civil rights movement can take. And it's happening at a time of incredible exhaustion on the part of people who had been motivated and moved by King's message at mid-century. And I think that you have this moment where people are saying, maybe it isn't legislation. You know, maybe the passage of the Civil Rights Act of 64 and the Voting Rights Act of 1965 didn't fundamentally change my life because Black unemployment is still a problem. And so you have people who are saying our next move is Black capitalism. We need to grow up out of marches and trying to seek integration and beloved community. And the bottom line is business and it's capital. And the Nixon administration is incredibly cynical. And they say, okay, how can we try to make a gesture toward Black America that isn't going to challenge segregation, that isn't going to really equalize opportunities? We'll say Black businesses for Black communities. You know, Nixon even says Black power in the most constructive sense of the term. Right. You know,
not in the radical term
or the good term, right? And, you know, for McDonald's part, McDonald's is successful because they know when to shapeshift. They're seeing communities change demographically, and they're seeing white franchise owners who no longer want to do business in Black communities. And they're saying, okay, we'll open the door to Black people to franchise restaurants in Black communities and see what happens. And it was incredibly successful. And so they kept on investing in that strategy under the guise of participating in the new civil rights.
I was really struck by the way you trace the history of the relationship between McDonald's corporate headquarters and the National Black McDonald's Operators Association. Describe what the NBMOA is and its fleeting but interesting and starring role in a part of American history.
So this is an incredible group that forms in the early 70s, and they represent the cohort of the first Black men, and they were all men, who had the opportunity to franchise a McDonald's. And these men are from very different places. And these guys are all, you know, kind of brought together by the fact that they are pillars of the community as Black business owners. They're incredibly generous with philanthropy, and they're getting the short end of the stick with McDonald's because they're often doing business in places that have a lot of high crime, broken equipment. And so they kind of come together and they try to advocate with McDonald's to say, you know, we're actually doing really well and our sales are really high, but you're not advertising in the publications and on the radio stations and TV stations that our customers are tuned into. You are not attentive to our need. So it's a strange kind of world that if you comply with the rules, you could make lots of money and you could still comply with all the rules and lose a lot of money. And this is part of the grievance that has long been part of the Black franchisee experience, that they are at a double disadvantage in a system where, you know, there's a lot of risk.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. More to come.
WNYC Studios is supported by Wondery. 50 high school senior girls descend on Mobile, Alabama every summer to compete for a massive cash prize. It isn't Survivor. It's one of America's most lucrative scholarship competitions for teen girls. It's been around for 7 decades. Now you'll hear what took place behind the scenes. From Pineapple Street Studios and Wondery comes The Competition. Host Shima Oliai was Nevada's contestant 20 years ago. Now she's returning as a judge to find out what 2 weeks with 50 of the country's most ambitious teens can tell us about girlhood in America. What happens when the competitors are thrown into the deep end with the best and brightest? And how does surviving the competition prepare them for everything that comes after? Follow The Competition on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can binge all episodes of The Competition early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. This episode of New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by ZBiotics. We all have busy lives these days and can't afford to waste a day on the couch because of a few drinks the night before. Luckily, a new product, ZBiotics Pre-Alcohol Probiotic, is here to help. ZBiotics breaks down the byproduct of alcohol responsible for those rough mornings. Try it today by going to zbiotics.com/radiohour and get 15% off your first order when you use Radio Hour at checkout. ZBiotics is backed with a 100% money-back guarantee. So if you're unsatisfied for any reason, they'll refund your money. That's ZBiotics.com/radiohour and use the code radiohour at checkout for 15% off. Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
You mention advertising and you devote an entire chapter, in fact, to the ways McDonald's has marketed to the Black community over time. What were the messages these campaigns were trying to send? And which do you remember most vividly? The Calvin commercials seems especially important to you.
So Calvin is an icon.
Hey, isn't that Calvin?
I haven't seen him for a while. Wonder where he's heading.
The setup is it's the early 90s and it's New York City, and you get this stereotypical representation of African-American young men on the block. They're not doing anything. They're loitering. And Calvin is bopping around the neighborhood and you think, ooh, is he bad as well?
Now that you mention it, there is something different about him.
But uh-oh, here's a surprise.
Looks like responsibility's been good for him.
Well, I'm just glad somebody believed in him enough to give him a chance.
Calvin is actually on his way to work, and he flips his hat and he says, "Welcome to McDonald's. How can I help you?"
"Welcome to McDonald's. May I help you?"
It was a multi-commercial campaign, and you follow Calvin as he gains more responsibility and people start to appreciate and look up to Calvin because he's working hard at McDonald's with the aspiration of one day becoming a franchise owner. So the thing that I found fascinating when I looked at the ads, you know, going back to the 1970s, is that a number of the ads that are targeting Black consumers for McDonald's don't talk about food. They talk about how McDonald's has economically empowered Black people.
Well, right. You make this interesting point that McDonald's often shows up in moments of cultural crisis in the country, especially racial conflict, like the 92 riots in LA. How did the company help create the blueprint for quote unquote disaster capitalism in Black communities?
The animating event that brought McDonald's into Black communities was King's assassination. And it grew out of this sense that if McDonald's could be the anchoring institution for communities in crisis, then it is proving itself to be more than just a restaurant in Black people's lives. And so after the LA uprising, McDonald's issued a press release that said, you know, none of our restaurants were damaged in South Los Angeles. And this is proof that our social investments in the late 1960s paid off. And I thought, wow, this is a wildly inappropriate thing to say. I don't think it's entirely true. But what I found fascinating is that people believed it. And they said, see, it's because McDonald's has been in our community. They've been giving us opportunities. And then when Ferguson happened, and that Ferguson McDonald's on Florissant Avenue, which is franchised by an African-American, you know, became kind of the epicenter of where people gathered during this crisis, I thought, this is really strange. But I think the idea that McDonald's is proximate or special to Black America is both problematic and strangely true all at the same time. It is about more than just food. It's about nostalgia. It's about emotion. It's about belonging. And so the reason why I think this is important is because when we hear all the chatter about health and obesity and race and food deserts, and we often reduce it to personal choices, or we suggest that it's because people don't know better about nutrition, it is very easy for us to dismiss why McDonald's might be important to someone. But from the perspective of 1970, when you think about the fact that Black people can't legally be everywhere they want to be in a public accommodation until 64, having a McDonald's in your community is a big deal. It does matter. And I think that those relationships have continued throughout the generations, even as McDonald's has been exposed as a creator of a lot of problems. I think in some communities, McDonald's has been seen as an entity to solve a lot of problems as well.
Your book is deeply nuanced. Now, I don't want you to be reductive, except can you be? When you look at McDonald's now, how do you think about the question of whether McDonald's has done more harm than good for Black communities? Is that even the right question to ask?
I get asked this question, versions of this question often, and all I can say is this. Capitalism starves people and never feeds them. That's the full stop. And I really wanted to...
Well, let's pause on that. What do you mean by that?
Well, I think that anytime we look to the marketplace, anytime we think that if we open up the pathways to enjoy the fruits of capitalism, someone and something gets left behind that is more critically important. And so when I think about McDonald's and Black America, I am concerned about how much McDonald's is paying people and the conditions in which people have to work. I'm concerned about the impact of this massive supply chain on the environment. And I'm concerned about people's health and well-being. And I think more importantly, I'm concerned that in moments in which Black people are crying out for freedom, for justice, for an ability to create stable communities, what they're offered is, let's open a business, or how about a franchise? But I want to be very clear. For all my critiques of fast food, I have a great deal of gratitude for all the people who have fed me through this portal called fast food. I ate a lot of fast food meals growing up and through my PhD program in my early adulthood. And I think I came to a deep appreciation for the high level of skill that is required to feed a lot of people in a short period of time. And so if one day McDonald's says, you know what, we're going to do this a little differently, and we're going to use our influence in order to upend poverty wages and the problem of work, then I think we get closer to this ideal that we are no longer going to allow corporations to have this incredible role in vulnerable communities, and we are just going to have a restart on how we imagine the quality of American life. A girl can dream.
That's Dr. Marcia Chatelain. She's professor of history and African-American studies at Georgetown University, and her book is called Franchise: The Golden Arches in Black America, and it won the Pulitzer Prize for History this year. I'm David Remnick, and that's our program. I want to thank you for joining us. See you soon.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Merrill Garbus of Tune Yards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrado. This episode was produced by Alex Barron, Emily Botine, Ave Carrillo, Rhiannon Corby, Kalalia, David Krasnow, Gofen and Putubwele, Louis Mitchell, Michelle Moses,
Annabelle Bacon,
and Stephen Valentino. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.